So I spent a bit of my time in my professional life working in corporate finance, which involved doing valuations and financial due diligence of small businesses. I always joked with my boss at the time that it was the easiest job in the world because to get to the value of a small business, all you need to do is work out what the profit is or the, you know, what finance people call the normalized EBITDA, and then you multiply it by three. So why is it three times? Why not a two times or even a 10 times? The topic can also be quite confusing because in the world of startups and technology companies, these businesses are often valued at multiples of revenue, not profit. So why is that? Hi, Jason Andrew here, and you're listening to Stark Naked Numbers, the podcast that strips down the numbers of business, investing, and wealth creation to help you become a better entrepreneur and investor and ultimately build your net worth. Today, I'm joined by dear friend and valuation nerd, Simon Cook. Simon is a chartered accountant and business valuation expert. Finance dorks refer to Professor Aswath Damodaran as the Yoda of finance. In my view, Simon is the Obi-Wan Kenobi. So in today's pod, we're going to give you a masterclass in small business valuations. If you're an entrepreneur that's either buying or selling a business, listen up. This may give you a slight edge at the negotiating table. Simon, welcome to the show.
Great to meet you, Jason. Lovely to be here.
Okay, so this is a pretty tough gig because what we're trying to do today is break down what is a fairly complex and highly subjective topic into a way that everyday people can grasp, right? So are you up for the challenge?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Well, I actually think it's quite a simple subject.
Okay, well, that's good. Well, there's a few places where we can kind of start and take this conversation. So I think what we might best, so we just start with the foundations, right? So, Warren Buffett said, price is what you pay, value is what you get. So let's start with, what is value?
Yeah, I mean, Warren Buffett sums it up really well there, doesn't he? Price is what you pay, value is what you get. So basically, Buffett is saying, you know, there's a difference there between price and value. And clearly, Mr. Buffett knows very well he's bought some bargains and he's paid less for something than it's really worth. But what do we mean by value? And value in terms of businesses, investments, is very specific because the value is intrinsic to the future profits, the cash flows. And so the more profits a business is going to generate in the future, the higher its value today. If it's not going to make any profits in the future, it's probably not worth much. So that's what value is. Whereas price is based on supply and demand. It's based on the movement and the momentum of the market. And so if there's lots of people want a particular business, and if you go to market and you create a very competitive environment and there's lots of egos, then people will push up the price, offer a higher figure. Whereas conversely, if your back's against the wall and you're having to suddenly sell your business, and it's an emergency, you've got to generate the cash, that's the worst scenario because clearly you're just going to take whatever price you can get. And that's the difference between price and value. Value is a function of the market supply and demand. So price is a function of supply and demand. Value is a function of cash flows, intrinsic cash flows.
Yeah, interesting. So I guess the hard part of that is really getting confidence of those future cash flows, right? Because if you're talking about intrinsic value of any asset, whether that's shares in the company or even small business, you need to have conviction that the business will continue to generate cash flows into the future, and will do so over a period of time. So how does one go about buying a business if it's based on the future? Like how do you do that practically?
Yeah, okay. Well, just before I answer that, just to reiterate what you just said, I mean, fundamentally, that's right. It is about cash flows. And I think this is really where accountants come in. Sometimes I wonder why accountants do valuations, because there's this corporate finance investment component that accountants don't deal with on a day-to-day. But really, the key component of value is cash flows. And accountants are probably quite good at that because they can understand numbers. The difference is, though, we're not talking about historical numbers. We're talking about, as you say, future cash flows. Now, the business isn't related to what it's worth in the past. It's about what cash is it going to generate in the next 5 years, 10 years, the next 50 years. So we are looking into a crystal ball. Now, clearly, if we're looking at a business that's been running for 40, 50 years, and it's been generating the same revenue, the same earnings with the same clients year in, year out, then we could probably, with some certainty, predict what it's going to do in the next 10 years. Whereas a startup or a tech company that's growing incredibly quickly, it's more difficult to predict. There's a lot more uncertainty about what those cash flows are. And so this is what you have in valuations, is a certain degree of uncertainty. But in terms of value, value really is very simple. Value is just a function of those future cash flows and a discount rate. And the discount rate reflects the return those investors expect to receive for the risks attached to those cash flows. So it's just two components, cash flows, future cash flows, and the discount rate investors expect to receive for the risk attached to those cash flows. And so it's just those two components. The difficulty is then deriving what those components are.
Yes. Okay. So let's unpack those. So cash flows, if I look at, need to work out what are, well, you know, project what are the future cash flows of a business, that in itself can be difficult, as you said, because there are some business, well, it can be easy and difficult, right? So if you pick a very boring, predictable business, let's just say it is a, let's just say the business you've got is a bridge, right? You've got this bridge, you know, we're both based in Brisbane, so let's call it, it's a toll bridge that connects, you know, one part of Brisbane to the other. And this toll bridge charges a rate for each car that drives through that bridge, right? So there's a cost for that, right? So this bridge has been around for 20 years. And I guess the revenues generated on that toll bridge is simply derived by the traffic numbers, right? The amount of cars that drive across that bridge. So if you were to look forward, say I wanted to buy this bridge asset off your bridge business. Sounds like a wonderful business, by the way, something I'd love to own. But if I were to buy this business off Simon, I would think about valuation. I would firstly look at, okay, what is the future cash flows of this bridge? And there's a few ways you could look at estimating that. And I guess one of them would be, what is the growth of the population growth of Brisbane? You know, how is the growth, you know, if there's more people migrating to Brisbane into the city, naturally, there's going to be more people, there's going to be more cars on the road, and hopefully that should, in theory, translate to more traffic use in that bridge, and that's one method you could kind of forecast those cash flows, right? Am I thinking in the right way about that?
Yeah, definitely, that's right. So you really, I mean, you say it's difficult to model cash flows. I don't know if it's difficult. I think there's, you know, there's obviously an uncertainty, but you have a go. That's all it's about. That's what Professor Damodaran says. Well, you just have a go. And, you know, he talks about Uber, you know, how do you, you know, project Uber? And you can be very optimistic that Uber is actually this facility company and it's, you know, all these different industries, or you just say it's a car, you know, it's a taxi business. And you have a different, and then, so Damodaran talks about the story, and the story is the cash flows. You know, where do you see this story? And so an example of your bridge, which is a really nice example, that bridge, because even though it's a simple business as such, you've actually got a few components. Like you say, you've got the population and the population growth, you've got car usage, and you've got the rate, obviously the rate, and then maybe there's different rates for different times of the day.
Yeah.
Then you maybe also need to think about competition. So obviously we've got the subway that's being built, the underground. Is that going, would that affect transport going over the bridge? What other bridges might be? And maybe I'm not a transport expert, but maybe there's views that people are going to cut down on cars and there's a trend in cars and actually that's isn't the way to go. And maybe there is a lot more investment in public transport, how that's happened. So you might end up with a few different scenarios. Yeah. But really your key inputs, as you said, are it's the number of cars and the price per car. That's quite simple. But in terms of modeling the number of cars, could take a bit of effort. I mean, obviously, the more effort you get, the tighter you get. And that's probably what a lot of valuation is you start with your cash flows. And as you go along, you start refining them. As you know, you start thinking, oh, okay, well, what if we change this? How does this affect it? And you refine your cash flows. But as you said at the start, you don't really know because it's in the future. We're just making a good estimate.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Great. So using the bridge example, let's just say I might do, you know, I guess the rabbit hole of this is you can basically tell any story you want, right, to try to estimate those cash flows. So you use the example of Uber. You know, is Uber a ride-sharing company, or is it, you know, a logistics company where it, you know, connects, you know, basically people with a logistical need, whether that's food or transport or aircraft or whatever. Like, you know, obviously the market share expands with that, and so does potential revenue. So, like,
yeah, I mean, just I'm going to stop you there. I just to be very clear, I mean, you can't really tell any story you want. The story has to be based on a certain amount of facts. And so clearly the Uber story, you've got the history of what it's done. You've got their strategic plan, what they're getting involved in. You then make a jump of faith of which direction it goes to. Yeah. But the story is still based on a certain amount. You're not saying it's going to get into competing with Tesla and go to Mars. You know, the story is pegged down to a certain extent, but clearly the more established the business, the more boring the story is, I suppose, that
you're
going to go. Whereas a startup that's dabbling in different areas, the story is, well, potentially is that you're at the beginning of the book, aren't you?
Yeah, that's a really good. So I think Tesla is a prime example of this, because I think people, there's two, what, you know, I think it's one of the probably the most valuable car company in the world in terms of market cap. I think, you know, I think it's if you combine, I think it's the if you combine, you know, Ford, General Motors, Toyota, you know, by add their market caps together or their valuations together, Tesla is the sum of all of them, right? And everyone, you know, there's two views of that. It's like, well, if you look at Tesla purely as a car company, yes, it is probably extremely overvalued based on, you know, traditional kind of comparables, which we'll talk about later. But another view is like, no, Tesla is not a car company. It is a AI robotics company, because, you know, Elon Musk is building autonomous humans. You know, that's part of their roadmap. And you shouldn't think of Tesla as a car company. It's basically a conglomerate of AI and vehicles and different startups within a large company. So I guess the challenge with valuing like those types of businesses is that the story really matters, right? in how you might derive the valuation, right?
Well, completely, that's right. Yes. I mean, we've talked about WeWork, haven't we? Because
yes,
worked in co-working spaces. And Adam Newman, the founder of WeWork, and just to the benefit of our listeners, though, no, WeWorking is a co-working space in terms of they let buildings, they rent buildings, and then they sublease them to people who just want to rent a desk or rent an office. So it's a building rental business, and nothing new about that. It's been going on for years and years. But what Adam Newman said, and he had this brand WeWork, he said, well, we're not an office space business. We're an IT business. You know, we're a tech company. We're selling efficiencies, and we're selling a lifestyle. And so he had the value was, it was about $40 billion, I think, wasn't it? Before he was going to IPO, but actually when they issued the IPO documents, the market didn't believe it. You know, they said, well, it's not an IT company, it's not a tech company, it's just a rental business. But depending on your viewpoint, clearly a tech company often going into lots of different areas and a lifestyle presents much stronger cash flows than just a boring renting desk business. It's a very different story.
Yeah, excellent. Good point there. So we talk about, the components of value of business, there's the cash flows. And I think we established the cash flows really matter on like, what is the story? What does the future look like for this particular business? And then what's the second component of the valuation?
Yeah, so the cash flows, we've got these future cash flows.
Yeah.
And then we're simply discounting those at a discount rate to give us a present value, a value today of all those future cash flows.
Yeah.
And so if it's $100 tomorrow, so it comes back to the simple concept, the dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow, clearly, because we have inflation to start with. Yes. We can invest $100 today in the bank, get an interest rate, say, of 10%. At the end of the year, it's worth $110. So $110 in a year's time is worth $100 today. It's simply what you're doing. You're just saying, okay, well, this business is going to generate $110 after year one. What's the value of that $110 with a discount rate of 10% is worth $100. Yeah. So it's just that rate, that discount rate. And I've used 10%, slightly higher rate than you get with a deposit. You probably get 5% with a term deposit. So then the issue is, well, what return should I be entitled to in this business? Because clearly there's a little bit more risk than putting my money in a term deposit to putting my money in the business. Should I be entitled to a higher return?
The question is, like, what, how do you establish that return, right? I think this becomes to, so how do you establish the discount rate or the required rate of return?
So, okay, so really, so this is all about then relative risk. Now, a lot of investors already have their own view about what return they want. And they say, well, okay, I want to have 30% return. I want to get my money back in 3 times. That's a typical thing you see investors do, isn't it? Just very simple. 3 times, wanting 30%, 35%. Or the other way you can look at it is, so, okay, well, I can get 5% in term deposits, or I can get maybe 3% in a 10-year government bond. So that 3% is my risk-free return, and there's absolutely no risk. I'm guaranteed to get 3%. Or I can put my money in the stock market, and I probably get 10% on average. And so there's a certain amount of risk in the stock market. I'm going to get 10%. Well, how does this risk in this business compare to me putting money in a portfolio of stocks? Well, there's clearly more risk because I'm going to have to put all my money into this business. Whereas my stocks, I could have a big portfolio, invest in lots of different industries, diversify away my risk, reduce my exposure. With this business, if it goes down, I'm going to lose all my money. So I want a higher return. So then building up from these other risk barometers or benchmarks to get to a discount rate that, you know, we think is reasonable to reflect the risk with this business.
Gotcha. Okay. So you're looking at, the argument is that if I buy this business, I'm putting all my eggs in one basket most of the time. Like, there's a lot of chips on the table. I'm investing this thing. Therefore, I actually command a higher return than I would if I just invested in the S&P 500 or an index fund. Right, because there's a lot more risk with just having it all concentrated into one bet. Yes. So that's one argument. The other one is probably like liquidity. So, you know, a challenge with investing in a private business, for example, is it's probably quite difficult to buy a business. You know, if I wanted to buy shares in Commonwealth Bank or Tesla, I just need to open up my web browser, log into my e-trading platform and press buy, and I've done the transaction. Where if I wanted to buy a private company, even a share in a private company, there's a lot more there's a huge process that going after to get lawyers involved, accountants to do diligence. I need to get contracts signed up, and then I need to do it. So often there's a hurdle rate to buy a private company, but it's also, so it's a hurdle rate. It takes me time and effort to buy the business, or buy a share in a private company. But then when I want to sell it, I also have to go through that same process. I can't just instantly click a button to sell my share in that. So that is a cost as well, right?
Yeah, it is a cost, and it's more difficult to ascertain. But yeah, clearly there's a liquidity issue, and some companies are less liquid than others. Obviously, you know, AI is all the rage, isn't it? AI companies, you can sell an AI company really quickly because there's a lot of people, a lot of potential buyers out there. Whereas maybe a more established manufacturing business is out of favor, it's going to take you longer. So there's a sort of lack of liquidity there. Now, the counter argument would say, well, does liquidity really matter? Because during the time I'm trying to sell it, I'm still making money. As long as I'm in cash flows, really doesn't make any difference. So you can argue that, well, actually, that liquidity doesn't really matter. Only then becomes an issue is that if it takes me 12 months to sell this rather than me to sell it with a click of a button now, in 12 months' time, the market might suddenly change, the government might change some legislation, and that could impact the value. So there's a risk there that, you know, liquidity causes impacts the amount of money you're going to get. And also, it's a function of the market. Liquidity is linked to how the markets are functioning. If the markets are going gangbusters, everybody's happy, liquidity isn't really an issue. But when the markets are tight, and liquidity tightens up, then the cost of liquidity goes up, you know, because investors are nervous and they want liquidity. So the liquidity cost changes depending on the economic conditions. But it is an issue about liquidity. How you factor that in is a different thing. I think practically, and certainly I see this, and I'm sure you see this, Jason, is that investors, when I'm advising investors on making acquisitions, we'll do some cash flow modeling. But the discount rate we'll just pick a discount rate that we think is a reasonable return. That's the hurdle rate. And how does that fit in? You really, as Damodaran says this quite clearly, you know, don't get bogged down in the discount rate. The focus should be on the cash flow. So pick a discount rate, 35%, 25%, whatever it is, but just really focus on what are those cash flows? What are the different stories, the different scenarios?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you know, to your point about liquidity and how that might change in different market cycles as well. So, you know, during, I think, 2020, 2021, when, you know, during COVID, there's a lot of stimulus payments, money printing by governments, there's a lot of cash flow around the economy, interest rates were zero. There's a lot of money sloshing around, and we saw, you know, all-time highs in technology, tech company valuations, everything was just kind of very, very high valuations. You know, fast forward just 4 years where it's a different, very different funding environment, we're seeing valuations crater. And fundamentally, actually, nothing's really changed with the businesses. The businesses are still the businesses. They're probably still hitting their internal targets. But what has changed is the funding environment where interest rates are a lot higher than they were. Investors are a bit more jittery and nervous about the economy. And so these businesses aren't getting funded as easily as they were previously, which has a natural supply demand consequence, which drives their valuations, right? So that seems to be a function. Liquidity is a function of the macro environment as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say that you sort of nothing's really changed in those companies. Of course, you know, some things do change. And so say for example, inflation. You know, we're at a very high inflation. Well, that increases your risk free rate. So that, you know, if your bottom level risk free rate suddenly goes from 3% to 5%, that's your base level has gone up. So that pushes all your discount rates up. So straight away, when you've got inflation, cost of capital goes up. So potentially prices are going to go down. But that should then flow through your cash flows, because if you've got high inflation, your future cash flows are going to be higher. Yeah. So as long as it doesn't impact the fundamentals of the business, shouldn't really theoretically be any difference to the value. But of course, inflation does impact certain businesses. It reduces demand. So that does impact the fundamentals. So again, some businesses stay the same. Some businesses do get affected by the changes in the economy and one of those factors.
Fascinating. And so, you know, we're talking about, cash flows and discount rates, but in the real world, that businesses aren't really valued on those mechanisms. Everyone talks about multiples. So can you, in your view, talk about how, like, what are multiples and how does that trend? How do we get from cash flows and discount rates to a multiple method of valuing a business?
Yeah, so I mean, multiple is just what the falls out. So if I come up and I say, well, okay, I've got projected these cash flows for this business, I've calculated my discount rate, and I come up with a value, and it's $1,000, and it makes it, and it happens to be making $100 in the last 12 months at EBITDA, or EBIT, whatever you want to pick. And so $1,000, $100, it's a 10 times whatever that number was, the earnings at EBIT, or 10 times revenue, whatever. So it's just that multiple is simply just something that falls out. So when you see multiples listed companies, you go on Yahoo Finance, Google Finance, Apple, whatever stock you want to do, and it'll give you the multiples of revenue, multiples of earnings. But all that is taking the market capitalization and then taking the earnings and dividing them and giving you the multiple. So the multiple is just what falls out. I mean, that is just what falls out. It's just that reflects what the pricing is. But what you find is that then valuers or people looking to buy businesses, rather than doing a cash flow and a discount rate, they'll just simply apply a multiple to earnings to come up with a figure. But I think that's really pricing. It's not valuing, because you're basically using some benchmark to give you an indication of the pricing. The multiple really simply reflects, what I would say, the value. So what are the things that are driving value? Well, it's the cash flows and the discount rate. But if our cash flows are growing quite strongly, so if we've got $100 earnings this year and we're going to generate $200 next year, and we've come up with a value today of $1,000, so 10 times $100,000, a 10 times multiple, that it's growing by $100 earnings next year, it's going to have $200. So our multiple times the forward earnings is only going to be five. It's going to be five times 200 is going to give us 1,000. Yeah. So that growth is very different. Whereas obviously a company that's not growing or growing very slowly, you'd expect that multiple to be a lot lower because it doesn't have that same growth in cash flow. So the multiple reflects, obviously, the growth in cash flows and the risk attached to those cash flows. So you've got to be a bit careful using multiples because it's fine if it's got a very stable business and it's chucking the same thing in year in and out. But once you start incorporating growth or changes in performance, then your multiple should change quite significantly.
Yeah, interesting. Because I think when people go to value a business, so, you know, we work with a lot of people looking to buy businesses and everyone talks about multiples, right? It's like, hey, what's this worth? So it's probably like a 3.5 times or 4 times multiple. Yes. But when they're doing that, what they're actually just pricing the business and actually, I find it extremely rare that unless you're quite sophisticated or worked in M&A or corporate finance, most people aren't doing a discounted cash flow model. They're just saying, oh, well, historically the EBITDA or the earnings have been $100. It's not really growing that it's been stable forever. It's probably not going to grow that much more. We're just going to apply with a rate of return to that, which is I probably need to return my money over 4 years. So we'll just apply a 4 to that. And suddenly, I'll value that business at $400. That's kind of how it's done in the practical world. But what you're saying is what we really should do is like take the extra step, do some basic spreadsheet modeling maybe and do it that way. Is that what you're suggesting?
I don't know what I'm suggesting or not. I'm just saying that's where it comes from. So
yeah,
if you're just looking at a well-established business, the revenue earnings is going to be the same thing, same amount, then a multiple makes complete sense because it's just that it's not going to change, is it? Was when it's the first place, which of course, with COVID over the last few years with inflation, most businesses I look at, the cash flows have been changing a lot. So to just suddenly apply a multiple to last year's earnings, the earnings could have been really poor, so in which case you're going to end up with a low value, or the earnings are going to be really high next year, or do we do a multiple against future earnings? So you aren't getting rid of a mess if you don't understand what's driving that multiple. And then the other thing is, from the discount rate, you've got to think about, there's a classic slide you see about as businesses go up in value, in the size of the business in terms of value, the higher the multiples they get.
Yes.
And I sort of think about that. I think, well, what's driving that? Well, there could be lots of factors. One is maybe as businesses get bigger, maybe they're growing faster, which goes to obviously cash flows going up. It could be that as they're getting bigger, they're attracting larger acquirers and listed companies have a much lower cost of capital than mum and dad investors. They have a lower return expectation, and so that drives your cost of capital down. But also larger businesses can take on more debt typically, and so then cost of debt is a lot lower than a cost of equity that shareholders require, and so your cost of capital is going down. So you've got different factors. You've got the cash flow, like I say, back to the real basics, cash flow, discount rate, what is changing. And the cash flow, the discount rate, feeding, effectively, that's where your multiple comes from.
Yeah. So, okay, let's translate that to a real world example, right? Let's just say that what's pretty common that I'm seeing is that people see a business that's cash flowing, that's doing $500,000 of EBITDA every year, so $100,000. It's been doing so predictably for the last 3 years, right? You say, cool. What's this business worth? I get a question all the time. It's like, well, what most people do is like, oh, it's between a 3 and a 5, right? So why is a 5? Well, if it's not growing, it probably doesn't warrant a 5 because there's no growth in that, in those cash flows. It's probably more like a 3. So why is it a 3? So you're saying that, well, as an investor investing in this small business doing $500,000 of profit every year or cash flow, we'll assume that they're the same in this example. I require a 33% return on that, right? One divided by 3 times is 33%. So as an investor, I require that return per annum.
Yeah, that's right. And so where does that come from? Well, so of course, that's return after tax. So before tax, you're more sort of 25%. And then so if you then work that backwards from cost of equity, well, a cost of equity for a listed company is typically about 10%. And so then you say, well, okay, that 10%, so market prices, gets a bit more complicated here, but market prices for stocks reflect just the systematic risk. So the systematic risk is just the risk within the economy, the whole market. It doesn't reflect risk specific to the business. So why does it not reflect risk specific to the business? Well, I suppose this is concept that if I have a whole portfolio of companies, so the classic example is if I buy umbrellas, an umbrella business, when it's raining, I'm making money, happy days. But when it's sunny, I'm not making any money. Unless you're buying umbrellas for the sun, of course. Whereas if I buy also some shares in an ice cream man, when it's sunny, the ice cream man's out selling his ice creams, I'm making money. And then when it's raining, he's not selling ice creams, but I'm selling umbrellas. And so suddenly I've cut my exposure to the risk of the weather. And so the argument is, if I invest in lots of different industries, lots of different businesses, have a portfolio, then I reduce my risk to the specific industries. That makes sense. And so that's what drives the market. So market prices only reflect a systematic risk. They don't reflect a specific risk, because the theory says that investors can diversify away that risk. Whereas if you're a mum and dad and you're investing in a business and all your money's going into that business, you're then, as we said earlier on in the podcast, you're completely exposed, you're high risk. And so your return, the required rate return that you want, is going to go up. So like I say, we have a 10% safer stocks. And then we then go, our next level up is probably private equity. So private equity come along and they have lots of wealthy investors in their portfolio. They're also investing in a portfolio. So those high net worth individuals have got more diversification. So they're probably going to expect maybe slightly a lower return, maybe 15, 20%. So then we're that level. And so then we're up to 25, 30% for a mum and dad investor in a business.
Gotcha.
So that's our cost of equity. But we've also got to think about our cost of capital comprises of our cost of equity, the return to the shareholders, but also our return to the debt holders. Yeah. And so the cost of debt, say, is 7%. So clearly, we want to have a lower cost of capital. So the more debt we take on, we lower our cost of capital. But then there becomes a balancing point where when you take on too much debt, the debt holders go, hold on a minute, you're too exposed here. You know, you're not covering returns by your earnings. We want a higher rate of return. Also, the more debt you take on, the equity investors want a higher rate of return, because suddenly they've got less money in the game. There's more that the money's going to go to the debt holders, so their rate of return goes up. So there's a trade-off. So we have this optimal point between debt and equity where you get your best cost of capital. But, you know, if we have businesses that are heavy capital intensive, like a manufacturing business or asset hire business, we could secure debt against those, you know, 70-80% at that low rate cost of capital, or like that low cost of debt. Whereas a service business maybe is going to struggle to get any debt, because they're only going to secure against goodwill, and banks typically won't lend against the goodwill. So we have those factors driving cost of capital.
So to take a step back, there's kind of three ways that you can think about the returns that investors would expect, depending on where they sit in terms of, I guess, their circumstances, right? So if I was to invest in the stock market, you know, cost of equity would be 10%. So I expect kind of an 8 to 10% return. Private equity investors, you know, they're probably comfortable with a 15 to 17% return. And then like family businesses or small, you know, individual investors buying a small business would kind of expect a 20 to 30% return. So they're, am I right to say that they're kind of the thresholds or the tiers, and then they basically back solve into a multiple?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it does range. And I think 30% of the cost of equity is probably about right, isn't it? And then maybe what you've adjusted for debt cost of capital is 25%. That's before tax cost of capital. You've got to think about where you're getting, is it after tax or before tax? You've got to be consistent there. And that's what, yeah, this is where you sort of get into the details. It all becomes maybe more complicated, but it doesn't have to be complicated. It's just, what return do I require? Yeah. You know, if you read up on startups and venture capital, you see these sort of higher costs of capital of, you know, 50% for a startup. You know, personally, I don't like to get into those high costs of capital because it just distorts the numbers. I think you're better off coming up with a, you know, regular cost of capital and modeling your cash flows. And say, if you're doing a startup, you say, okay, well, I'm going to have, say, 30%, but I'm going to have this scenario where it's going to make all this money. in this scenario, it's not going to make any money. So there's a 20% chance it's going to fail. And build it that way rather than, because once you put a high discount rate, 50%, it all gets a bit silly. I think build up your cost of capital. Just use a regular cost of capital, like I say, looking at the markets. But ultimately, as we keep saying, returns are subjective. They're based on the investors. If some investors are prepared to take a lower return, some investors want a higher return. That's what you find is practically, as you know, when you go to market with a business, you're going to get different offers. And so that comes back to price. You know, some people are prepared to pay a high price, but that price might be because the value is worth more to them because they have a lower cost of capital. Or they think the cash flow is going to be higher, and then this is where it comes from.
Yeah, and I guess just to that point, so it's pretty typical in private equity firms to do like a roll-up of businesses, right? So they'll say, they'll look to do a roll-up of vet clinics. They might be, the argument behind doing a roll-up is that, hey, there's costs of, all these small businesses have a duplicate costs. They've got their own accounting fees. They've got, their own HR. They're doing their own marketing costs. If we buy these small businesses under a big brand, we can centralize all those costs into a corporate model, which actually lowers the overall cost of the entire business. So there's like synergies in the commons that can be realized if I buy these businesses. So in theory, a private equity buyer might pay a bit higher multiple, can afford to pay a bit more higher multiple compared to other buyers, because they can realize higher cash flows through that model relative to on the
bottom. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, theoretically, of course, the account argument said, well, why would I share any of that value? Because that's in the future that I'm going to create. Why would I give it to you? But of course, practically, if it's a competitor, and this is why, if you go into market and you look at, if you're looking to sell your business, you really want to create a competitive bid process. When I say competitive bid process, go out to lots of potential buyers. You set a very tight deadline in 3 weeks, read the information memorandum, the sale booklet, and then you make me an offer within the 3 weeks' time, you get all the offers in, and then you're going to create this sort of bidding process ideally. And of course, that sort of bidding process, egos can kick in, and then price starts separating from value. And then obviously, as you said there, maybe a primary equity firm that's looking to roll up and get some synergies has got a bit more leeway. So I'm like, okay, well, prepare to pay a bit more to get this under the belt. And also, of course, you've got to think about what they're thinking and planning. Sometimes you might be saying, well, we want to take this company out, or we don't want these other people to buy, so we prefer to pay a high price just to get rid of them, There's all these factors come into play about, why you're buying something, it might not just be to do with the cash flows. There could be other reasons. And then you might be buying a business because of the people in it. You really like the people, or there's some aspect that really isn't reflecting the cash flow, but there's something you can see. In fact, coming back to WeWork, when Adam Newman met his first investor, I think he said, what's it worth? What's the value? And Newman picked a number. I think it was 15 million. He just picked a number. Because it was just an idea at that stage. It wasn't making any money. Yeah. And the investor bought in. And of course you get, well, that's crazy. And he bought a 30% share, $5 million, whatever it was. Why would he do that? It's crazy. But of course that guy's now made vast amounts of money because he had a third share, which went to $40 billion valuation. Presumably sold some shares as he went along. Because he was in the story. He bought into the story. And of course the company, the value grew. But of course, if you looked at it on the basis of numbers at that time, it was like, well, it's not worth anything because it hasn't got any cash flows. Yeah. So that's the real fundamental difference between price and value. And I suppose, pricing, if we think about, say, for example, something different like pictures, or paintings rather, value of a painting, intrinsic value is next to nothing, is it? It's just a piece of wood and a bit of canvas. But it has a price, and the price is based on buyer's expectations that it's going to go up in the future. There's some price inflation there, or you just love the piece of art, or a bit of both. But there's the expectation. So when you see these startups, are you really investing in the value and the story? Are you really just investing because you expect the price to go up and you're going to get out when it's higher in the future?
Yeah, and I think the same argument you can make for things like Bitcoin, right? Like, you know, your question, what is the true intrinsic value of Bitcoin? It doesn't generate yield. It's like a currency. You know, one view is that it's worth nothing. There is no intrinsic value, yet, you know, the price of Bitcoin, it's very volatile, but it's actually probably at all-time highs right now. And that's purely driven by supply and demand thing, right? So
exactly what it is. And of course, I've drawn the similarity between some of these startups and Ponzi schemes. Are just the benefit of listeners, if you're not familiar with Ponzi scheme, the way a Ponzi scheme is, you know, investors come in and there's nothing actually going on. The money's just piling up. But as new investors come in, they buy out the original investors. And as long as you've got more investors coming in than going out, you're building your pyramid, you're building your Ponzi scheme. So the classic one was Bernie Madoff, $65 billion Ponzi scheme. And he was just making it, the numbers are broken, but he had more investors coming in. Now, and I was actually involved in that study when we were analyzing it. You know, banks were investing in that, and the allegations were that some of these banks knew it was a Ponzi scheme. They had to know it was a Ponzi scheme because it didn't make any sense. But their view was, well, as long as we get out before it collapses, doesn't matter, you know, as long as we get into the right level and get out. Yeah. So, you know, and that's what a lot of investing is it in the market, is getting in, buying at the right time and selling at the right time about the pricing. Nothing to do. Just going back to your roll-up story, though, which I think one of the important things about roll-up and the synergy bit, I think, is probably less of an issue. But obviously, a listed company that's doing a roll-up that's, you know, accountants or vets, you see all these different roll-ups, you know, their cost of capital, I say, would be, say, 10%. They might be trading at 10 times, or maybe they're trading at 20 times. And so if they're trading at 20 times, if they buy your company for $100, as soon as they add that value, it's going to, earnings at $100, that suddenly it's going to be worth $2,000. So they're more going to be happy to pay a much higher multiple for your business, because as soon as they bought you and it's listed, they've added value to the shareholders seemingly by magic, just because they've got their trading at a much higher multiple than any private business could reasonably expect to get.
Yeah, they call that the multiple arbitrage, right? Which is the probably the key feature of a roll-up strategy is that, yeah, as you said, my cost of capital is lower because I'm a bigger business or I'm listed. I'll buy these, still a fair multiple, but because that's earnings accretive to my business, that just translates to a high valuation. And so therefore you could, yeah, you know, they could afford to pay a high multiple relative to other bidders. So I wanted to talk about EBITDA for a second. So I always spoke about cash flows. Quite often businesses are priced on a multiple of EBITDA. And I think that the idea behind EBITDA is that EBITDA, for the listeners, EBITDA is earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization. It was, you know, kind of invented, I think it was in the 80s by John Malone, who was a guy basically rolling up telecom, cable networks. They were basically trying to get to a proxy for cash flow, right? And so if I buy this business, what cash is this going to produce? And the concept of EBITDA was introduced because I'm trying to get to what's the cash being produced? And so depreciation and amortization are like non-cash items. They're just like book entries. So ignore those. Interest, I'm less interested in the financing of it, because if I buy it with no debt, well then, you know, that's not going to be a cost to me. And so, yeah, you add all these non-cash items. So really EBITDA is supposed to represent cash flows, but it often doesn't. If you've got like a working capital intensive business, like maybe you've got some inventory, or you've got like high accounts receivable, these working capital items are a big impact from getting EBITDA back to what we call like free cash flow, right? Which is how you typically look at value in a business, because you're pricing those free cash flows into the future. And so that's kind of when people apply a multiple to EBITDA, that's usually the first consideration to make when people are doing this pricing exercise, is to say, well, is EBITDA actually the same as cash flow? And in some instances it is. If you're looking at capital light businesses like software or services, EBITDA, you know, is, you know, fairly representative at a high level to free cash flow. But if you're looking at more capital intensive businesses, that's not always the case. What's your take on this?
But first, a quick message from our sponsor. Are you tired of traditional accounting firms that only focus on tax and compliance, looking for a financial partner that can go beyond the numbers and reveal the story those numbers are telling? SBO Financial aren't your typical business accountants. We're your dedicated financial management team, empowering you to take control of your finances and gain clarity and confidence in your business. Sure, it will keep your books in order and file your taxes, but unlike traditional firms, we'll also go beyond financial hygiene to give you the forward-looking insights and strategies you need to grow your cash and profitability. Picture this: a team of chartered accountants, CPAs, bookkeepers, payroll specialists, and financial analysts all working together to help you grow your business. With SBO, you gain access to a collective team of experts and specialists, providing you with proactive advice and analysis. So don't settle for reactive advice. Stop looking backwards and start looking forwards with SBO Financial, your partner in financial management and growth. Visit our website or contact us today for a free financial health check at sbo.financial.
Okay, I mean, this is a good question, and I think possibly it's confusing a couple of issues. So let's come back to our discounted cash flow model where we're talking about cash flow. So you said free cash flow. So just part EBITDA, let's not even think about that. You know, cash flow is our revenue, less our costs of sales, less our overheads. That gives us our, you know, our profit before tax. That's, again, we've got to think about what cost of capital. If we're using a weighted average cost of capital, that's our cost of capital for both our debt holders and equity holders. So we're not going to include interest as our cost there. So we're going to have a profit before tax, our earnings before interest. And then we've got our tax, 25% or 30%. And then that's the cash. So that's the cash that's then available. Practically, what cash is then available to our investors? So both the debt holders and the equity holders. So we've got to pay our debt holders 7%, and then whatever's left is going to be to our equity holders. So that's our sort of basic cash flow. But like you said, you've also got to think about what other cash have we got. We've got capital expenditure. And so, you know, we talked about stories of growing companies. Well, if it's growing because it's investing in manufacturing, then clearly there's an upfront cost of investment, capital expenditure, and that's going to impact those first few years. And that's practically what's happening, isn't it? The money's going out. So you might have depreciation is very insignificant, but your capital expenditure is large. But also we've got capital maintenance expenditure. You know, to keep a business going, you're going to have to keep looking after investing in capital. And that practically also needs to be reflected. So again, these capital intensive business, manufacturing businesses, asset rental businesses, you really need to think about what the capital expenditure is. And as you also then you talked about working capital. And so wholesalers, retailers, they hold a whole lot of stock. How does that stock change with revenue? What's the obsolescence? What stock maintenance costs have they got in there that's over and above the costs that are reflected in the profit and loss? So there are certain other elements you've got to think about in terms of cash flow. So that's cash flow. Then you're talking about EBITDA. Now, EBITDA is just a measurement for comparison purposes. And so we talk about EBITDA multiples because we can take an Apple company, we can say take its market capitalization, we can see its EBITDA, or we can infer a multiple, whatever crazy multiple that is. And then we can take another company that's also take their EBITDA and apply the same multiple or adjust the multiple. So in terms of our pricing comparison, so that's where EBITDA comes in. And the reason EBITDA is sometimes used is because different companies have different depreciation rates. So there might be different depreciation in different countries. And particularly, again, asset-heavy companies, telecoms is a good example. Telecoms are highly asset-intensive, and they might have different depreciation policies in different countries or different companies. And so to allow comparison, rather than using EBIT, you know, after their depreciation, and so one might have a very high depreciation charge, one might have a very low, you're going to get very distorted comparisons using EBITDA. So the EBITDA is really there for pricing purposes to allow a level playing field. Like I say, it's really more applicable to those heavy intensive, capital intensive businesses where there's going to be a lot of depreciation, or IP where there's a lot of amortization. The EBIT there is really then, again, to compare it. One company's got a lot of debt, one hasn't. Clearly, if you left the interest charge in, you're not going to have to compare it like with like. So let's do on an EBIT basis, because should it really funding at this level shouldn't make any difference. We need to look at the businesses on a level play field. So that's really where my mind is about EBITDA. And I wouldn't start confusing the cash flow. The cash flow is the cash flow, what it is.
Yeah. 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 People still apply multiple to EBITDA. So should they be applying multiple to cash flow?
No. Because they're two different things. The cash flow is part of your discounted cash flow. The cash flow is your cash flow.
Yeah.
Divided by your discount rate gives you our present value. The EBITDA, EBIT is all about pricing multiples. We're using we've found some companies and they're being priced at 5 times, 10 times, whatever. And we're saying, okay, well, they're at 10 times, they're at 5 times. Mm-hmm. We're going to apply those same multiples to our earnings, and that'll give us a price. Two different concepts. One is value, intrinsic value, and one is pricing you to using multiples by observations. And they're two different approaches. Well, one's what we call an income approach, which is a discounted cash flow way, and one's a market approach, looking at market evidence.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense now. So we've got fundamentally there are two different methods of one's a price market approach method, which is your EBITDA multiplied by multiple, but the true intrinsic value, the intrinsic value approach is doing the work of a DCF, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the approach is rather the methods. You know, the market approach is three bases to a market approach. Same way as if you're valuing a house or pricing a house, we're looking at other houses on the same street or in the neighborhood, same sort of size. We're looking at the same number of bedrooms. How do they compare in pricing? Now, that's one way we can price a house. The other way we can, so that's the market approach. And we're looking at comparable transactions, other businesses that have been sold and bought. The other way you can value a house, or more likely a commercial property, is that we can look at what rental it could make, and we could discount that rental back, and it gives us a value. So that's the income approach. But also in a market approach, in terms of businesses, we've got listed companies which we can look at. We've got transactions that we can look at. And there's also obviously slightly bigger companies, shareholders come in and go out, and they bought and sold at a certain price, and that gives us some guidance on pricing. So there's sort of three components to that market approach, or three different methods.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And so the market approach, one way that I've observed, and part of the due diligence work that we do is really just getting an understanding of what is that EBITDA number, and how much comfort have we got around that. And we typically do what's called like a quality of earnings analysis, where we try to firm up that EBITDA number that's being reported in the accounts, or the historical ones anyway. And so there's this concept that's been introduced called normalized EBITDA, right? Because you start with what's reported in the accounts, but then there's a bunch of adjustments that happen to get to a normalized version. And this is very common in small businesses, because small businesses often use their business as kind of a personal bank account as well. Now, they might put their personal car through the books. They might not pay themselves a full market salary for personal tax reasons. So there's a bunch of adjustments that typically happen that need to happen typically when pricing a business in the market approach to understand what is the true EBITDA or earnings of this company. One of the common questions that we're getting asked from the audience, and one I would address, is how might sellers inflate the EBITDA position in the set of accounts? So we spoke about, the common one is market value salaries. So they might be, the owner operator might be underpaying themselves for the work they actually do. And so that naturally inflates the EBITDA or the profit position of the business. And the argument for that is, well, if I was to replace that CEO with someone in a market salary, like that's actually going to cost more to the business, and therefore that EBITDA would reduce. Another example that's pretty common is that you typically get a bunch of ad backs. So there's all these personal expenses that are put through the books, which the seller is saying, actually, no, these are private expenses. There's a personal car in here which is used for personal use. There's a bunch of travel here. I've put my international holidays through the books to claim a tax deduction on my trip to Italy, which may or may not have had a business use to that. Another pretty common thing is seeing employees who are actually working overtime to do the same task, but they're only doing, so they're being unpaid for that. So with new owners, they might command a higher salary. What other things have you seen in your experience of any funky ad backs that you've seen in solar accounts to much.
Flunky ad bat. Sorry. Okay. Well, let's just be clear what we're trying to do then. Of course, you would know this. Doing it. Well, first, if you're buying a business, you need to get some good due diligence, a top piece of advice. And in that due diligence process, clearly then looking at the cash flows, what the business can this generate. And what we're really trying to get at is, as an investor, what cash flow am I going to get? You know, what am I actually really going to get? So some of these costs, you know, and there's either, you said, you talked about, some of these costs actually don't reflect market rates, or they're costs that are not really to do with the business, or the one-off costs, the costs that, you know, maybe we've had some redundancy costs or some legal costs, and some of these just aren't going to happen again. So when we're doing our cash flow modeling, and, you know, we're keeping it fairly simple, we're just saying, okay, what cash flows can we really expect? And so that's, guess, where this sort of normalization comes in. We're trying to say, well, what can we really expect next year and the future years in terms of cash flows? And, you know, as you said, you've talked about, you know, maybe personal expenses going through. That would be typically in owner-managed businesses. You know, the bigger the business, and once you get multiple investors and owners, then that's less likely to happen. So you just don't see many normal. In fact, you wouldn't see any normalization, maybe market salaries possibly. But the more investors there are, and the bigger the company, clearly public companies don't start normalizing expenses or revenue, unless there's something fraudulent going on. Which does happen, obviously, but because there's all the rules and measures in place to stop them doing that. But mum and dad business, clearly they may be tax advantages for running it in a certain way, and they've put those sort of costs. Then maybe the investor coming in, it doesn't expect to have those. So that's really, is putting your hat on, going, okay, what cash flows am I going to expect? And so obviously you talked about market salaries is a really common one. I do valuations for matrimonial matters, for divorces, and then a common one would be the husband or the wife that owns the business either isn't taking a salary, in which case there should be a salary in there, whatever it is, for the running of the business, or they're taking a very high salary, in which case the profits are understated. So either way, the profits need to be adjusted to reflect, again, what an investor could expect to receive. Rental property that's owned by a trust, there's then rented to the company, that's very common. And then is that rented then at a market rate? Again, is it maybe the rent's too high, in which case profits are understated, or the rent's too low, profits overstated? So those are sort of simple ones. But, you know, there could be all sort of complex things in there. I'm trying to think of some funky ones, but it could be any costs that, like, for example, I've just done one now where there's quite a big profit share going to other, it's not a profit share as such, it's for staff as an incentive. So as an investor, are you going to have the same policy and pay that same sort of profit share or not? That's, again, you've got a view, or is that the way the business is run? That would be that sort of expenses there. Conferencing expenses and marketing expenses, maybe the marketing expenses are very high, and is that really required, or actually is that part of the running cost of the business, or have they already invested and they're going to grow the business? And the sort of actually almost, I mean, Dama Darwin talks about this. So maybe some marketing costs, even though this isn't an accounting standard use, could actually be capitalized because they're representing investment in the future. You know, leases, obviously we've got the standard on leases now and how leases account for. That's a bit more simple, but, you know, you need to account for Dama Darwin before that used to talk about capitalizing leases. So it could be different things, research and development. Again, you know, common thing, obviously, with the COVID rules about write-offs, writing off investment in fixed assets. You know, you have a big amount there. So again, you need to think, well, okay, that's an investment in the future. And then there's a tax consequence there as well. That gets a bit confusing because you've had the tax benefit, but you're going to be paying tax on those investments in the future, that fixed asset in the future. So you need to reflect if it's material. That I've seen that happen a few times. Big asset-based companies having big write-offs. So you're basically getting all the tax benefit up front. But, you know, in the future, you're losing the depreciation benefit in the future. So your cash is going to be higher. Your tax is going to be higher. I'm not a tax expert, but so there can be all sorts of different areas that need to be adjusted for. So normally we're talking about things that aren't at market rates, are one-offs, also some discretionary costs that maybe aren't ongoing.
I remember doing a financial due diligence gig for a business many years ago who had this employee on their books, and they added back this employee in their normalization adjustments. And so we dug a bit further. I was like, why are you adding back this staff member? That's really weird. Isn't that person work here? And anyway, long story short, that person was a mistress of the owner. So kept the mistress on the books, which was quite interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's but yeah.
We had wonderful
things. The mistress come with the company.
Yeah, well, apparently, yeah, well, right.
Not. I think what? So I had valued a cattle shipping company many years ago, transport business, had lots of these transport cattle trucks, which are incredibly expensive pieces of kit, $500,000 a piece.
Yeah.
And in that situation, they were aggressively depreciating these trucks over 3 years. And so what was then happening is obviously depreciation charge was high, so your profit was reduced.
Yeah.
Book values were much lower than the actual realizable values.
Yeah.
But then you'd also see these profit on the sale of trucks going through the P&L. So all that needed to be reversed out because that clearly wasn't part of that wouldn't be part of your cash flow. Again, it comes back to this capital expenditure when you're doing your cash flow. So obviously those sort of things you need to adjust for.
Mm. It's a big one. Capital expenditure is a big kind of cost that people don't really factor in, particularly asset heavy businesses. Sometimes that's just forgotten about.
Particularly in growing, that's right. Point about this, if you want to grow, you've got to have capital investment. That's how it is.
That's right.
And so that has to be reflected in the cash flows.
100%. Yeah. So just probably the last topic I wanted to go over is enterprise value versus equity value. So this is actually quite a confusing topic for a lot of people who have maybe in the process of the first time buying and selling a business because, start with, hey, we've got this number. We agreed on, this business price of 5x EBITDA, and call it, say it was $100, we valued this business at $500. But then once all is done, we get to exchange the money. You're actually giving me $500. That $500 is a lot less than it was. So where'd the money go? And I think that if you're doing a share purchase, if you're buying the shares in this company that owns the business, quite often there is a difference between enterprise and equity. You're buying the equity value of the business, not the enterprise value. So can we talk about that as a topic? What is the difference between the two and how do you get from enterprise?
Isn't it funny, isn't it? Because it does seem to be confusing enterprise value, but really it's very simple. I'll come back to the housing actually example. So, if you've got your house and it's worth, say, $1 million, then you can sell it for $1 million and you've got a mortgage of $600,000. So the value of the house is $1 million. That's the value of the business. That's the enterprise value, if you want to call it. That's right.
Yeah.
But the equity you've got in the house is the price less the debt, the mortgage is $600,000. So actually your equity in the house is only $400,000. You've got a house that's worth $1 million, but it's not, you haven't got $1 million because you owe the bank $600,000. So it's very simple, but it does seem to cause a lot of confusion. I mean, I see it in matrimonial matters. Seems to be confusion that, obviously, we're usually looking at the shares, and if there's a lot of debt in the company, then that debt needs to come off the value of the business to get to the value of the equity. But normally, we talk about enterprise value, the value of the business, again, for comparative purposes, because we're trying to get, this is the value. And the reason for that is to allow comparison, but also we say that funding is at the discretion of the buyer. That one buyer might decide, well, I don't want any debt. Another buyer, particularly private equity, say, well, we're going to take a whole lot of debt because it's really cheap. And so we take the funding out. We say, well, okay, let's just ignore funding, which is why when I talked about cash flows, we tend to do it. We don't include interest cost in there. This is a cash flow available to whoever's going to be debt holders, equity holders, or just equity holders, whatever it's going to be. And then we can change our funding structure. So that's at the discretion of us. So that's why it comes about. But really, enterprise value, very, very simple concept. It's just the value of the business. But then the equity is the value after you've paid off your debt.
Yeah, it's a good point. So typically, you start off with the value of the business. You then adjust for net debt because sometimes you typically include cash in that equation as well.
There's the same, cash and debt.
Cash and debt, same thing.
It offsets the debt, yeah.
So at the end, Using the house example, in the same numbers, you buy a business by having $1 million of enterprise value with $600K of net debt. So actually what's paid to the buyer, so what the buyer pays to the seller, if they were to take on that debt as well, the buying shares in the company, is that they actually write a check to the seller of $400,000, which represents the equity value of that business, right? Of the shares of that business. Because the buyer is assuming that that's $600K of debt. Where there's another adjustment actually is a working capital adjustment, which is again another confusing part in deal math, particularly when you're acquiring businesses in the real world, is that the enterprise value of a business includes working capital, right? So that's all built into that price that you're paying. And I guess part of when all is said and done, you shake hands, you get to completion or like start to exchange the money. Sometimes that working capital balance is different to the normal level of working capital. So sometimes there's an adjustment, and actually quite often there's an adjustment, what's called a working capital adjustment, to compensate either the buyer or the seller to compensate for the difference in that normal level of working capital.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Exactly right. Exactly.
Yeah, and so what is confusing for a lot of people is then, when it's all said and done, there's this further adjustment. There's not just net debt, there's also a further adjustment to working capital. So and sometimes that can swing either in the buyer's favor or the seller's favor, depending on how the cards land at completion with the numbers. But that's just another element that people get that's really confusing for a lot of folks. And maybe it warrants another podcast completely, maybe some spreadsheet.
It can be confusing. But again, I think if you look back to simple cash flow, it isn't really, so when you're doing a cash flow, we talked about this, we've got a movement to working capital. And so, if revenue is growing and this requires working capital, this business, not all businesses have positive, where some have negative benefit, negative working capital, but if it's a positive working capital, say as a percentage, so say 10% of revenue, as your revenue grows at 10%, your working capital requirement is going to grow. And so your cash flow is going to reduce. That's kind of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But when you're doing your cash flow, you need a starting point, your opening working capital. So I would normally say, well, okay, well, what's the average working capital over the last 12 months, 6 months, depends what the business has been doing. It might be changing, in which case working capital more recently is more accurate. But we're having an opening working capital figure that is actually what's on the balance sheet. Well, either we've got two options. We either use what the closing working balance sheet working capital is at the valuation date, or we're using an average. Now, I would tend to use the closing figure, and so and then I have my adjustment in the year, and then we've got an opening figure for the following year. So if we got, so for example, a wholesaler is a good example. If we've got a wholesaler, importer, exporter, they've just shipped in a container of goods from China the day before we bought the business. Clearly, they've got more stock probably than they normally would carry because it's all just come in. So they're going to have a large amount of working capital, a large amount of inventory, maybe compared to what they do normally on an average basis. So maybe the inventory is 20% of the revenue. Well, that all flow through your cash flow, because if you're saying actually the work capital is normally 10%, what you're happening is in your first year is that there'll necessarily be a benefit, an uplift, because you won't have to invest in working capital because you've already got it. So that all flows through your cash flow. What happens practically what I see anyway in terms of transactions, deals, is that the parties will say agree a level of working capital, they say based on maybe the last 12 months or whatever the balance sheet is when they start looking at it. And then they'll say, well, okay, we've priced it on that level of working capital. When they come to do the transaction or sign on the sale and purchase agreement, if that figure is then changed, we want an uplift or whatever a reduction in price to reflect those moves. And so it's only just a simple way of dealing with it. Which makes complete sense because you've already modeled it and that's moved in it. And so that's really, see it particularly, like I say, in heavy working capital-based businesses, retailers, wholesalers, where you carry a lot of inventory and there can be a lot of, it can change quite a bit month by month. Now, there's lots of businesses where working capital is same in, same out. Your services business, it wouldn't really change. So it's just to take account of those if it does change.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so they're typically the main two adjustments that you get from enterprise equity. It's the net debt, and then there's usually a working capital adjustment that happens at completion. So wrapping up now, I think that one final thought, I know we kind of discussed this theme throughout the conversation, but I think I really wanted to address it as a topic. So fundamentally, technology companies, you know, SaaS companies, you know, software, they're valued at crazy multiples relative to traditional businesses. It's quite common that these businesses are trading at, you know, the empiric is like, oh, how do you value a SaaS company? Oh, it's, you know, depends on its growth rate, but it's between like between a 10 times of annual recurring revenue or revenue, where in other businesses, we would look at multiple profit. Why are they so different? Why do we apply revenue-based multiple to certain businesses and more of a profit-based approach to others?
That's a really good question, Jay. So look, that takes us back right to the beginning, doesn't it, between price and value. And you're saying how we're valuing it. Well, you're not. You're pricing them on these multiples. And you know, clearly, these tech companies have a story when people are very optimistic, or there's just a lot of people want to get on board. And so they're pushing up the prices. And there's maybe not a disparity between the value, which is down here, and the price. And then maybe at some point, the price will come down. That's one side. So, you know, some AI stocks in fashion, prices are going up. Does that price really reflect value? Possibly we don't know. Is it just the mood, the momentum, the enthusiasm in the market? So that's the first thing, price and value. And the second thing is around value, is that, you know, these SaaS companies, and we just said before, you know, if your growth is increasing, then within a couple of years, you know, your revenue is going from $1 million to $100 million. And so, you know, multiples, instead of if you work back from your cash flows and reflect to that in a multiple, you're going to have a vast multiple, because it's making $1 million now. In 3 years, it's going to be making $100 million. So clearly, it's worth an awful lot of money from a cash flow perspective. If you divide that by the $1 million today, it ends up with a very high multiple. So you usually see revenue multiples. You know, and I refer to revenue multiples because if I have got a very high growth company, the earnings are really quite meaningless, because it might even be making a loss. Or if you've had companies that, you know, they've had a funny year and the earnings have gone down, then the earning multiples just are not very helpful. Whereas, you know, revenue, obviously, there's more, allows a certain amount of comparison. Clearly, you lose the, you know, the margins, etc., but it does allow comparison and some basis for making that. And so, you know, the revenue multiples do make sense, but like I say, it's pricing, it's not valuing. You're pricing it based on an expectation that this thing is going to start making a lot of money in the future, and that generally actually those high cash flows.
Or someone else buys it off me, right? back to the Ponzi scheme.
Back to the Ponzi scheme analogy. You know, I just think these things are going to keep going up. That's what I'm going to do. I mean, you could say the same thing about property. You said, well, property seems to be residential property, maybe overvalued. Others say, well, it's not, because the price is going to keep going up. Where do you take your view on it?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, well, this has been a great conversation. Thanks for your time. So, any closing thoughts or remarks on valuations?
No, I don't know. I really enjoyed that. But like I say, you said valuation is complicated. I don't think it is. Valuation is very, very simple. It's just cash flows and discount rate. Cash flows and discount rate, simple as that. The difficulty comes about is making judgments about the cash flows and the discount rate.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you subscribe on your app of choice. You can also find more financial insights at starknakednumbers.com or follow me on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. I'm Jason Andrew, and this has been the Stark Naked Numbers podcast.